Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And this week, we're going to have a conversation about something that's near and dear to my heart. And we've been circling around it and talking about marriage and relationships for all 15 years that I've been doing the show. But today, we get to have a conversation with someone who actually influenced my thoughts and beliefs about marriage and relationships from the beginning of my time as a psychotherapist and also throughout my 40 years of marriage with my husband. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time just chatting about the topic because I want to spend a lot of time with our guest. But I will say this. Very early on in my marriage, probably year 5 or 6 into it, and we had dated for 5 years before we got married. So we felt like we had, you know, put a lot of time in. We hit a really tough, rough spot. And we weren't quite sure how to move forward. Both of us were immovable forces at the time. I thought, well, I guess that's the end of our marriage. And what was interesting was that when we mentioned this to, you know, friends, or if I had said something, you know, Chris and I are really struggling, I don't know if we're going to make it, or he mentioned, it's like, I don't know how we're going to get out of this. Our friends almost across the board said, well, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce and you just didn't make it. And no one said, well, you need to stay in there, or this is really important, or you need to fight for what you care about. Most of the response was just, oh, well, I guess you just move on. Fortunately, my parents, of all people, were the ones who stepped in and said, well, you're not coming back here, so you need to stay there and figure out what you're going to do. And you've made a commitment, so you need to honor that. And they were the only people who actually kind of forced us to reevaluate and to take it more seriously. And obviously, at the bottom of our hearts, we wanted to stay. We just didn't know how to find our way back. And so that began kind of this journey of reforming our marriage in a way that really represented us. And it's a longer story than for today's show, but let's say it involved a 4-month trip living in our Volkswagen bus, driving around the country and figuring out that all we really cared about was each other and our then 3-year-old daughter. And that's the story that created the new chapters of our marriage that have now gone, as I said, almost 40 years. So I've always focused my work on being the person who will say to people who are struggling, are you sure you want to be done? Do you understand the long-term consequences? You made this commitment. And it's interesting to me that even today in 2024, the conversation of marriage is still, well, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce. And that people accept it as if that's just, oh, well, the way it is. When we understand the fallout from divorce is rarely easy. So today our conversation is with Michelle Wiener-Davis, licensed clinical social worker and author of 8 books. Her seminal piece is Divorce Busting. And we'll get into that because that title says it all. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation after the show, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Instagram. You can leave me a message there as well. And you can also podcast our show by visiting wherever it is you find your podcasts. Search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Forever could never be long enough for me. I feel like I've had long enough with you. Forget the world now, we won't let them see. But there's one thing left to do. That the weight has lifted, love has surely shifted my way. Marry me today and every day. Marry me. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And my guest today is Michelle Wiener-Davis. She is the founder of the Divorce Busting Center in Boulder, Colorado. She's recognized for her groundbreaking work with couples on the brink of divorce. Michelle is also the author of 8 books, including her best-selling seminal piece, Divorce Busting, and also The Sex-Starved Marriage. Michelle's most recent book is entitled Healing from Infidelity. She's also a sought-after speaker. Make sure you check out her TEDx talk about the sex-starved marriage. It was very helpful, short, and got to the point. And you can also visit Michelle's website, divorcebusting.com, for more information about how to get in touch with Michelle or maybe do your own divorce busting work. Michelle, thank you so much for being a part of my show today.
And thank you so much for having me. I'm excited about being here.
So as I mentioned in the intro, you've influenced a great deal of my life, and a lot of it started from my own early kind of hitting a dead end with my marriage early on and kind of coming back. And so I'd like to start with what inspired you to write Divorce Busting or even look at divorce back in 1992?
Well, to answer that question properly, I have to like sort of backtrack a little bit. For 9 years after I got my graduate degree, I did family therapy. And like most therapists, when I worked a lot with adolescents and their parents were having issues, I always thought to myself, well, you know, they're having difficulties. There probably are irreconcilable differences. And perhaps what we need to do is find gentle ways to break the news to the kids and make sure the kids were in support groups and, you know, that the parents were doing the best that they could to focus on the kids' needs rather than their own. But what I discovered was that in so many of those cases, not only was it really, really tough on the kids, but also there didn't seem to be this trickle-down effect that we all imagine there will be, where if parents are happier, kids are going to be happier. It just doesn't work that way. And in many cases, I sometimes say, I wish I had a dollar for each time someone said to me, you know, Michelle, if I recognize how much work it takes to make my life good after a divorce, I could have used that same energy and focused on my marriage and kept my family together. So that's part of what really got me thinking more about the idea of not just looking at divorce as a rite of passage, which so many people seem to do these days, as you said, Elizabeth, but really let's slow down, you know, let's put a speed bump here and let's really think about what can you do differently to make your marriage work again. But to be truthful, that was the professional catalyst. I have a personal catalyst, which is certainly, I would say, an even stronger motivator for me to be doing the work that I'm doing. I grew up in what I would consider an East Coast version of the Walton family. You know, I had two parents who adored me and two brothers who sometimes adored me, but we were, you know, we love each other very much. Big extended family, always with family. I mean, holidays and, you know, vacations. I will never be in a therapist's office complaining about my childhood. It was great. My parents never, ever fought. And then one day I was a senior in high school, just about to leave home. And my mom sat my two brothers and me and my dad down for a family meeting, which, by the way, was not the norm in my family. So I suspected something was up. And it was there that she announced that she had been unhappy for 23 years of marriage. Keep in mind, we didn't have a clue. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, she'd been to a therapist and the therapist just suggested that there really was no way to resolve the differences between my mother and my father. And that she really just had to go find herself. And I sometimes jokingly say, Elizabeth, I'd like to find that therapist. And that ended my parents' marriage. And at that moment, it was so traumatic because keep in mind, we never saw our parents fight, never, never. It was so traumatic, but I knew that it would end my parents' marriage. What I didn't know was the very insidious ways that it would end my nest was falling apart. My extended family never got back together again. My mother was the hub of the wheel in terms of social gatherings. And when she got divorced from my dad, she resigned from that position. And it was never the same. And there I was going off to college and no home to go back to. It was incredibly profound for me. And so when I really began my own work in terms of being a therapist, I don't care what therapists say, your personal experience influences the way that you work with people, even two people practicing the same therapy model come at it from different perspectives depending on their own life experiences. And so I started to really allow myself, instead of having this myth that we're supposed to be neutral, there is no such thing.
Yeah.
That I really started to focus on when people would tell me that, you know, I love him, but I'm not in love with him anymore. This whole falling out of love business more and more started to show up, in my view, as a skill deficit. Because people go into marriage with really great intentions and amazing hopes and aspirations. Their eyes light up, you know, when they get married. What happens just a few years later? And I think what happens is what you were talking about, Elizabeth, people hit bumps in the road and they don't know how to navigate those bumps. And they grow further and further apart because whatever they're doing isn't working. And then they start telling themselves stories such as that they don't love the person anymore. They were focused on all the wrong things and they chose the wrong person. Mm-hmm. The list goes on. And I began to really experiment with teaching people skills to get through those hard times, normalizing bumps in the road because we all have them. And what I started to notice is the more I believed that change was possible and that they could work things out, the more that began to happen. And the more it began to happen, the more convinced I became that I was right.
Yeah.
And so it was about that time that I knew that I had to take what I was experiencing and write about it to address what I consider to be a high divorce rate in our culture. And that prompted me to write Divorce Busting. And by the way, at the time, it was very taboo for therapists to say, I have a position here, I have a stance, and this is what it is. And this is what, especially when there are kids involved, that you owe it to yourselves and you owe it to your kids. And I'm not saying childless couples are different, but especially when you bring people into the world, to make sure you've left no stone unturned and to have the tools necessary to make changes if it's at all possible. And when that book came out, it was a lone voice. And it was a media frenzy, and which I'm so grateful for, not just because I loved the success that I was experiencing, but because I really do think it had a profound effect on people who read the book and really put a speed bump in between that unhappy feeling and going straight to a divorce attorney. And I'm just as committed today, many years later. So that gives you a little bit of background.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Michelle Wiener-Davis. She's a licensed clinical social worker and the author of 8 books. And today we're focusing on her first book, The Divorce Busting, and also the follow-up book, The Sex-Starved Marriage. And it's interesting, Michelle, because those things do so definitely go hand in hand. And one of the things you mentioned in your TED Talk and other work is that so few couples even talk about sex ever. They can be married for 20, 30 years. And I found in my work, that's one of the first questions I ask couples is, when's the last time you had sex? And that usually is pretty telling because it feels like a piece when the wheels come off. But
by the way, let me interrupt for 1 second. It's not just couples married for 20 to 30 years who don't talk about sex. They go to get help, and therapists often don't even ask about sex.
For sure. Yes. Yeah. So let's jump into the therapy piece as well, because I'm proud of our profession overall, the potential of our profession I have faith in, but considering the show is The Reluctant Therapist, the directions that therapy has taken people has in many cases been devastating. And what you mentioned was that a therapist was at the heart of your mother's decision to leave. And that post-second wave, you know, divorce boom in the late 70s, early 80s was led by a lot of therapists who were holding drum circles and parties and celebrations about people who were leaving marriages. It was like therapy in many ways was the driving force for that spike in divorce. And then therapists were the ones who started focusing on children needing therapy after their parents got divorced. And so all of a sudden now we've pathologized children's reactions. I have such issues with the way, in some ways, that therapy has actually led the downfall of our relationships and not worked to boost it. And I don't know if it's, I don't know where to start with that, but I'm sure you have thoughts.
So I always, when I think back about my mother's experience, I always say that I think she was a victim of the 70s and the therapists who, you know, were practicing back then, and the culture of, you know, if you're unhappy. And my mom at the time was a stay-at-home mom and she wasn't satisfied. And I totally get it. Mm-hmm. But somehow she was led to believe that her path to happiness was getting a divorce, getting out of that incarceration called marriage, and going to find herself. And she did find herself. She had this amazing career. She was a therapist and very, very successful in her own right. But she didn't have to get divorced to do that. So that's one piece of it. And in regards to what you said, Elizabeth, about therapists recommending kids going to therapy, you know, I always tell people when they say, you know, do you have a recommendation for our kid? If, you know, we're not going to make it, we want. I'll say, yeah, my recommendation is talk to your kid. You know, mm-hmm. Your kid is going to have feelings about this. Mm-hmm. Talk to your kid. Make sure you're explaining what's going on. Do the best that you can. And make sure your child knows that you're there to be able to help them to the best of your ability. You don't have to pathologize this. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, you and I are so in sync about this.
And it's been a career long frustration, because my wish is that parents got good parent coaching. I mean, and then became the experts with their children. Like, that's useful. And then the idea that therapy would become like a lifelong activity, I think, has also harmed people, because they get so connected to what my therapist said and what we're doing in therapy and my therapist, that they stop taking responsibility for actually living their life. And one of the other things that you've been involved is this idea of brief psychotherapy or short-term psychotherapy. And I know we're jumping a little bit from the divorce blessing, but I think it has something to, you know, I think it's important, because one of the things that you've talked about is that you don't have to go into divorce busting therapy for years and years, that you even have kind of leaned into these short 2-day intensive therapies to help people move forward. And so I'd love to talk about, you know, your work around brief family therapy and solution focused brief therapy, and this idea that therapy can be a time capsule, and it doesn't have to be years long to be successful.
Well, I think what is at the root of lifelong therapy, mm-hmm. is that most therapists in graduate school don't learn that therapy should be goal-oriented. And look at, so if you don't have a goal, you can go to therapy weekly for the rest of your life, because all you do is go in and the therapist will say, how was your week? Well, who couldn't do that for one's life, right? You become friends with your therapist, and there's nothing wrong with really liking or even loving your therapist. But the point of the matter is you hire a person for a reason. You should be clear about those reasons. You need to be goal-oriented. How will you know that this interaction with your therapist has been helpful? What will you be doing differently at the end of the day, at the end of the session? That will be a clue to you that this has been helpful. And that whole mindset, as opposed to, is really the one that it was such a huge shift for me when I started to be exposed to the work of Steve DeShazer and Intu Kimberg at the Brie Family Therapy Center in Milwaukee. This was back in the early 80s. I knew out of graduate school that if I didn't get some additional training, that I was going to switch careers. I really was. I was starting to think of what else could I do, because I was pretty clear that asking people, my mantra of asking people, but how do you feel about that, wasn't going to be enough. Mm-mm. Because people would, they were experts at talking about their feelings, and it didn't change a darn thing. And also that old idea about if you help people, this is real therapy blasphemy, but if you help people understand why they're doing what they're doing based on childhood experiences, that it will create change in their lives. Look, I'm not saying that that is not an incredibly interesting journey. And for some people, it is helpful. But what I discovered time and time again is that insight doesn't necessarily lead to change. It leads to insight. I had the most insightful clients in Northern Illinois where I was living, but they were clueless about what to do to make their lives better. And that's when I got exposed to the ideas of solution-focused therapy. And after 9 months of training with Steve DeShazer, one of the originators of the model, I was so hooked, because it was such a sea change in the way that I thought about helping people change, that you have to have goals, that you have to focus on people's strengths and their resources rather than their pathologies. You know, when therapists focus on people's pathologies, down the road, they may get to the same point of helping them. But to me, it's like dragging people out in the middle of a lake in order to save them. You know, if you look at what people, if you look at people's strengths, mm-hmm. and how resilient they've been and how they've solved maybe comparable problems in the past, and remind them of who they really are, it's a great springboard for beginning to resolve the problems at hand. And so I was so hooked, Elizabeth, once I was exposed to this new way of thinking. And when I got invited to become part of their team, those were certainly some of the most exciting years of my career, to think that people don't have to be in therapy for their whole lives, to think that people can identify what they want to change, how they can know when they're making progress, how they know when the problem is solved, which isn't to say, by the way, that they can't come back a year later, or 2 years later, because they're dealing with something else. That's all okay. But to really just to go into a therapy situation, to just talk about what's going on with no idea about, you know, there's a saying, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time, you know? And so I'm allergic to that these days.
Well, and what I find interesting is that when I came up through my training, you know, it was talk therapy, insight driven, you know, doing the deep dive work with families. And then as I came out, we were finally moving towards the strength-based work that you're talking about, this focusing on strength and the narrative therapies and the solution focus. And I also really, I think I have more of a coaching heart anyway, or a counseling heart. So that really spoke to me. And that work was really satisfying because it was goal-oriented and had tasks and people could move forward with their lives. But what I find interesting is that in the last 5, 6, 8 years, and you know, the last 6 years for sure, I feel like we're shifting back towards this insight-driven, what's my trauma, what was my childhood, and we're, people are getting sucked back into these really deep holes that are keeping them stuck, especially young people, because so many of them are in therapy or on medications now, that they're in this eddy of, you know, their life, of all the ways that they're not functioning, or they're special, or they need accommodations. And I feel like we've gone backwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's wonderful that you have your podcast, because I think some of it is people just don't know that there are alternatives. And I applaud you for what you do because of that.
Well, I wish that it was a grander scale, because I feel like as we're slipping backwards, we're losing a whole generation of people. And to kind of bring it back to the marriage piece, you know, if you look at surveys of people who have been in long-term longevous marriages, you know, 2/3 of people who've been married 50 years or longer, and I'm telling you nothing that you don't already know, but 2/3 say that they really had a satisfying life. You know, it's either still passionate and wonderful, or it's good and comfortable. Only a third of people in long-term marriages say, I just stayed because I didn't know what else to do. And yet we don't focus on the strengths of long-term committed relationships as the foundation of really good mental health. And isn't that Harville Hendrix's whole song?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think gets in the way of, you know, I was alluding to the therapist mantra being, how do you feel about that? I think the mental health field has done a great disservice to people in putting this whole concept of how do you feel about it on a pedestal, because people are so tuned in to their feelings, and they then believe that if they're having a bad feeling or a lonely feeling or a conflictual feeling, that it dictates their actions, that they have to do something. When the truth is, sometimes feelings are random firings of our brain, and they're almost always transient. Mm-hmm. And so, and also I tell people this all the time, if you stop and interview anybody who's been successful in any walk of life, whether it's marriage or being an adult child to a parent or being a friend or being a parent, they have a vision of who they want to be in those relationships. And sometimes feelings conflict with those goals. Like the example I always give couples is that one of the most important things to me in my life has always been to be a good mom to my 2 kids. And I remember that part of my definition of being a good mom was having a bedtime ritual, reading them bedtime stories. I had a career, I was busy, I had a marriage. Did I always feel like reading them bedtime stories? Absolutely not. Sometimes I was exhausted and I just wished that they could put themselves to sleep. But then somehow I turned down the volume of that feeling, and I kept in my, you know, right, my vision of who I want to be. And I read them bedtime stories. And it's the same thing in marriage or anything else. It's like, who do you want to be at the end of the day? And sometimes you're going to have feelings that misguide you. Don't make them the primary focus of your life. Yes, it's wonderful to be in touch with them, especially, I mean, intimacy, you know, comes from, you know, being able to be in touch with those feelings. But keep in mind that sometimes feelings misguide you, and they're temporary and they're transient, and they can change with what you do or what you stop doing. And that has been a primary shift for me.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Michelle Wiener-Davis, licensed clinical social worker, author, and founder of Divorce Busting. Divorce Busting centers in, do you still have the Woodstock, Illinois, and Boulder, Colorado?
Well, we still have a home and office there, but I do all my practicing here in Boulder, Colorado. And then very often people who can't travel, I do a lot of virtual work as well.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation about divorce busting, marriage, the sex-starved marriage, and also solution-focused brief therapy and maybe how we need to return to that focus in our work as clinicians. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. At me and smile, I'll understand, and in a little while he'll take my hand, and though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And we continue our conversation with my guest, Michelle Wiener-Davis, licensed clinical social worker and founder of Divorce Busting. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, I came across Michelle's work probably when the first book was written in 1992, and it had a great, great influence on my own marriage and also the work that I've done as a clinician for the last 25 years. I am an unabashed fan of marriage and long-term committed relationships and the power of those relationships to center our mental health and well-being. I loved the work of Harville Hendricks, who talked about marriage as a path to spiritual wholeness, because we have this idea that we have to do these solo journeys to find our way to ourselves, when really it's with the witnessing of another person along the journey that it helps make our lives feel so real and so full. I mean, just think about it. If you're on top of a mountain seeing a beautiful sight, when you can turn to someone and say, look at this, it has a much more profound effect than just taking it alone. And that in itself is a great endorsement of those long-term committed marital relationships. So Michelle, as we continue on.
Can I add something to what you're saying there?
Please do. Please do.
We could go on forever here, but I think when you talk about long-term committed relationships, and, you know, I mentioned that I've been with my husband for 50 years. We went to the same college. Who else really would know the sort of the innuendo of some of the jokes or some of the stories? And even now, you know, as we have grandchildren, I feel so much gratitude for having worked through the hard times. And there have been many hard times because I don't think anyone could love our grandchildren as much as we love them together. It's sort of like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And it's so, so worth it. It really is.
I agree. And it's funny because I've said many times to clients people I work with, think hard and long before you leave this relationship, because no one will want to hear you talk about your kids as much as the person you made them with.
That's a great way to put it. And it's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Yes. So, and now I interrupted you. So
no, that's okay. Again, we can go eight directions, but I want to go back to having written the book in 1992, and here we are in 2024. What has changed, stayed the same, or surprised you, or about marriage, the state of marriage in that period of time from 92 to 2024? Because clearly you still are going forward. I mean, Divorce Busting Center is thriving. So what's changed, yeah, or is the same or different?
Well, you know, it's for one thing, if you believe the statistics, we learn that fewer people are wanting to get married. I don't bump into them, but, you know, that's, and I know you have something to say about that, but.
Yeah. Well, because in the 15 years I've been teaching family psychology, and again, who's taking my classes probably skews the data, but 95% of my students continue just to even to last quarter say, I want to get married and have a family. I want to get married and have a family, and I want it to last forever. And so that's a great starting point. And my follow-up question always is, what would prevent it from lasting forever? And their response is generally, well, half of all marriages end in divorce. And I will say, what if I told you that that is false? That with a college degree and getting married over the age of 25, the divorce rate is 19%. So if you went into marriage understanding that divorce is only 19% possibility, mm-hmm. how much harder would you work to make it last? Because my belief is that the vast majority of divorces are a result of people believing that divorce is inevitable.
Well, and also even across the board, Elizabeth, the divorce rate has gone from what used to be 50% to 41%. There, in all demographic areas, the mm-hmm. divorce rate has either leveled off or dropped, except for one. And this, and maybe this answers your question. It's in the group of people who have been married over 20 years, 20, 25, 30 years. They're getting divorced. It's called gray divorce. And there are many reasons for this, but I have a lot of these people in my practice. And here's what I've learned just sort of on the job training in working with these people. So many people, they adopt this philosophy of divide and conquer in terms of getting tasks done in their life, whether it's raising kids, supporting a family. They do what they have to do, but they forget to prioritize their relationship. They don't have date nights. They don't have conversations. They don't have time for sex. They don't do those nice little things that people do for one another early on in the relationship. They put their relationships on the back burner. And oftentimes, it happens a couple ways. One person is often more upset or troubled by this growing distance between them, or sometimes they both feel that way. And guess what? The kids leave home. If you do a good job, your kids leave home. They spread their wings. And there you are with a stranger. And you're looking at this person and you're thinking, I am not happy. I only have X number of years left in my life. And I want to be happy. I want to feel closeness. I want to feel connection. And these are people who file for divorce. And, I'm sure no surprise to you that it seems so tragic to me that they've gotten to this place where now they don't have to take care of kids. Many of them are in a much more financially stable situation. They can begin to do things that they've put off doing. And, you know, it's my job to convince them that change is possible so that they can rediscover what they once loved about each other. But that's a really big issue in our culture right now in terms of marriages.
And so people who come to work with you, what is that? What does it look like? What are they signing on for? Because you mentioned earlier the importance of goals and understanding what it is you're looking for when you come to do the therapeutic work. So what is the process that they're signing on for with you?
So I don't know how many years ago is over, probably 20 years ago, I decided back in the day, I'm backtracking now. Back in the day, like most therapists, I did hourly sessions. And what I discovered is that people would often wait until the last 10 minutes of the session to say what was really upsetting them. It took a while to warm up. And so we had 10 minutes left. We'd be talking about emotionally provocative, emotionally laden topics. The bell would ring. Mm-hmm. I never liked ending sessions on a bad note like that. So I'd go a little bit longer. By the end of the day, I had people in the waiting room. I don't even know why they put up with it, to be honest with you. And it didn't go well. So the people at the end of the session, they would have bad feelings, and those bad feelings would go home with them. And they would be there over the course of the week. And when they would come back, we had no traction. You know, we had to start all over. And so it got incredibly frustrating for them, for me, because I really wanted to help them. And so I decided I was going to do one day long sessions, one day. And I wasn't sure I would have enough to talk about, but it didn't take long before I discovered that for most people, who especially the couples in my practice teetering on the brink of divorce, one day was just scratching the surface, and I quickly added on another day. And I began to just do that exclusively. I stopped doing hourly sessions except for follow-up sessions after an intensive. I believe in the power of doing follow-up so that people can really incorporate what they've learned and have it become more second nature to them over time. Your question is, what are they signing up for, is a great one, because I can't believe anybody signs up to spend 2 days with a complete stranger, not knowing what's going to happen. I do begin all of my sessions with wanting to hear what is their goal? How will they know that coming to work with me has been helpful to them? And a huge portion of my clients, one person desperately wants to save the marriage, and the other person just as desperately wants to get out. I consider it child's play when, regardless of the nature, severity, or longevity of a problem, when couples come and they both want to be in the marriage, to me, it's sort of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Because starting with that commitment, you're almost home, right?
Absolutely.
But when couples come in with different agendas, different goals, different aspirations, I use the 2 days. This is more along the lines of what I would call narrative therapy than solution-focused therapy, because I developed a way of, after I know a little bit about what their goals are, I tell them I want to get to know them better, and I want to hear about the story of their relationship, not the story of their childhood, but the story of their relationship. And we begin at the very beginning. And I it's so interesting, and I'm sure you've had this experience in working with people, when they reflect back at the beginning of their lives together, they loved each other. They were in love. And we talk about those things. And you can actually see people's affect change when you do that. And I go through the chronology of their marriage almost teeny step by teeny step. The good things, I certainly join in their celebration of the good things. Sometimes people have had many good experiences, but they tell themselves, all couples handle it that way. All couples have those experiences. And I beg to differ very loudly. And I help them to see that they're either those wonderful experiences or their very unique, resilient, creative ways of handling hard times, mm-hmm. Is actually extraordinary. And for many people, it's the first time they've ever heard something like that. And we go through their entire lives. It's sort of like when you have your life flashing in front of you, only I'm sort of directing the show. And I co-author a new story with them, where they're looking at their strengths, where they're looking at their possibilities. And Elizabeth, what I so often find is that there are skeletons in the closet that happened long ago, mm-hmm. that nobody talked about. And yet that is the cancer in their marriage. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Lots of people have had difficulty getting pregnant or staying pregnant and doing IVF. And it's really hard on couples, the whole process, even when there's a successful outcome. But many people have miscarriages along the way. And so when they get to having had a miscarriage, I stop them and I will say, tell me, what was that like for you and how did you handle it? Well, one couple recently, the woman began to cry and she said, you know, as I think about it, that was the beginning of the end for me in this marriage. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, because I know men and women are different, but I was so surprising for me to have the and he didn't care. He didn't talk to me about it. He just didn't care. And I knew that we were incompatible at that moment. So I had her talk about what it was like for her, but then I turned to him and I asked him, I said, she's saying you didn't care. I'm kind of curious. Would you say that's true for you? And I can't tell you how many times men in this position will say it was absolutely not true for me. I cared so much. It hurt me so much. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to make it better. And then I had my own pain. We would have had a son. And the only thing I could think of to do to make myself feel better is to really dive into work to distract myself. So when you were working and when you weren't talking to her and when you were in a different place, it was because you were struggling emotionally. And he goes, absolutely. And it's the first time she's ever heard something like that. So for me, even though I'm not writing more books at the moment, helping couples rewrite their history in a way that allows them to celebrate their successes, to have compassion and grace about the hard times. Honestly, people say to me, that was such a useful exercise because we haven't thought about those things and we certainly haven't thought about them in that way. And that's a huge part of what I do. It's not the only thing that I do, for sure.
And I think that the rewriting the history is so important as well, because I think the revisionist history gives people almost an excuse or rationalization for why the marriage didn't work, and to have to go back and honestly look at the history as it really did happen, I imagine be incredibly freeing. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Michelle Wiener Davis. She is the founder of Divorce Busting. And if you'd like to find out more information about Michelle or dive into divorce busting, you can visit her website, divorcebusting.com. Just to swerve the other direction real quick, as I'm listening to you, because both of us clearly have found our place in this intensive work and these long-term, because I found this, I've moved to that same model of doing long, intensive, short bursts of therapy and helping people just get back up on their feet and move forward. And I'm wondering if we need to focus that more with young people as well, because I've really come to feel strongly that therapy should not be part of a young person's life. It should be counseling or mentoring. It needs to be called something else. And that they have these intensive counseling, coaching weekends or times to just, because they don't have enough lifespan, you know what I'm saying, to need to have months of therapy. It's like, it should be short term because they're only 20, 15, 20, 25 years old. I wonder how that narrative model that you're talking about could be applied to prepare young people for a more successful long-term marriage in their life. Like, I wonder if we need to be pre-doing the work that you're having to do on the back end when people get into trouble. How would your model work at the front end?
For many years, I was involved in an organization called Smart Marriages. And it was all about marriage education. And marriage education shouldn't begin 2 weeks before people get married, or even during marriage. I'm all for that. But I love the fact, and I don't know what's happening now because that organization has since disbanded, but we were in schools, we were in junior highs, we were in elementary schools teaching children about relationships. The young people you're talking about in their 20s would so benefit from learning, first of all, the myths that people believe that I think fosters hopelessness and despair when they hit normal developmental stages in marriage. So really teaching people, what is mythical thinking about relationships? I once wrote an article called The Marriage Map, and it outlined 7 predictable stages that all marriages go through, just like with children, you know, the developmental stages that children or families go through. It's predictable. And knowing that it's going to happen and knowing when you're there to be able to say, oh, yeah, this is where we're at right now, instead of catastrophizing. And learning some really, really basic communication skills, like being able to listen, being able to use language where you take ownership for the way you see things and the way you feel about things, language that doesn't prompt defensiveness, learning more about patterns that work in relationships and patterns that don't work in relationships. There are some generic universal rules about that, but also I think what is so unique about solution-focused therapy, as opposed to, you know, many models that assume it's one size fits all, is really asking the couples in my practice, for example, and there would be no reason 20-year-olds couldn't benefit from this. What's different about the times when the two of you are feeling more connected? What are you doing differently? What's different about the fights that seem to go better? How are you talking to each other differently? What's different about the times when you've had a fight, but the aftermath doesn't last for days and days and days, where you get back on track quickly? Helping people really take a look at their successes rather than their failures. We are so focused. People always want to tell me how their fight started. I listen, but I'm much more interested in how it ended. What did they do to get back on track? What did they need to do next time differently to really short circuit the impact of having a disagreement? Those are the kinds of questions I think anybody, regardless of age, could benefit from.
Absolutely. Those basic relational skills would be so powerful. You know, I don't know where you add it to STEAM with all the ways that we're trying to raise children. And then there's, you know, so we have a STERM, we had relationship skills, because I agree that we could, you know, if our focus as a culture is all about mental health and reducing stigma and all the, you know, buzzwords around mental health and everyone needs a therapist, really we could probably reduce the need for mental health care by 90% if we taught people the skills that you and I know and that people have to pay to get. And I think you mentioned in your TED talk that you have this desire to give this knowledge to people if you're in line at Costco or wherever you are. And it's the reason I started this show, is that I wanted to give away this information because it shouldn't be so mysterious how relationships work or how you can get out of trouble. I find that so frustrating that people need to pay to know how to retain love. And the other piece too, Michelle, is so many of the young people I work with are embarrassed to say that they want to focus on their marriage and families, that they have been enculturated, you know, to believe that it's all about their career and their productivity. And that if you say you care about love and marriage, that somehow you're not utilizing your gifts or whatever the story is. But we have to get rid of the shame around wanting to nurture relationships.
Well, you know, I've heard it said that at the end of the day, there are two things that matter. One of them is service, and the other is love. And unfortunately, I think people learn that lesson. Some people learn that lesson too late in life. You know, I've had this incredible career. I have such gratitude for it. I really do. But at the end of the day, if I didn't have kids who wanted to spend Thanksgiving with me, I would not feel successful. Family and loving each other. I mean, which leads me to another point, Elizabeth, which I can predict you and I will be in sync again about. The permission and actually encouragement that so many people get from therapists to have emotional cutoffs in their families because of so-called toxic relationships. I mean, even just saying the words right now, I have a knot in my stomach. And one of the things I started doing at the end of my trainings, probably 10 years ago, even though I'm doing training on helping with therapists to help them do divorce busting work or to help couples have better sex lives, at the end of all of my training, I start to talk about the importance of not encouraging people to have emotional cutoffs and to not have them themselves. And I give a whole description of why I think that is so important. And when I do, you know, and I can have 1,000 people sitting in the audience, you can hear a pin drop because everyone has either had one or encouraged somebody to have one. And the truth of the matter is, even though it may feel on paper safer, you know, you're taking care of yourself, there's always this drumbeat in the background about this person who you have cut out of your life. And I'm not saying everybody has to have a very intimate, ongoing, daily interaction with people who are difficult, but to have some interaction and to not completely cut them out of their lives, to me, is one of the most important things.
And one of the most challenging things, because it is in many ways easier to walk away. It kind of goes back to the divorce busing piece. People see walking away from the marriage as the easier thing and better for the kids than staying. And yet, the same with cutting off or having, you know, strict boundaries of way people interacting, it churns on you for a long, long time. As you're mentioning, it's like you may cut the person off or you might get divorced and move on with your life, but that narrative or that story, that unresolved piece, continues to operate.
Well, plus if you have kids, mm-hmm. you never get that person out of your life completely. And I think that's one of the myths people believe is I'll be done. And you're not done if you have kids.
Mm-mm. And then the other piece of it that I've noticed is that a lot of parents who've been through divorce, their well-intentioned advice to their children is, don't get caught like I did. Have your own money. Be sure that you can take care of yourself. Never fully commit yourself to another person, because that way you'll prevent yourself from being devastated when you get divorced. And then it unintentionally sets up their children for divorce, because they go into their marriages, right? Half out the door. And so it becomes... What was it?
Is it? I'm laughing because I just spoke to someone yesterday who said, I watched my father stay in an unhappy marriage. And I promised myself, I will never do that. I do not want to be my father. And I said to him, I'm so glad that you're committed to the idea of not being in an unhappy marriage. But if you really want to be different than your father, have a happy marriage. Figure out ways to have a happy marriage. Your father never did that. Leaving is just the flip side of the same coin. Having a happy marriage is truly doing something different. I say that all the time.
And my follow-up is usually, if you end up getting divorced and you truly, truly committed yourself and loved this person, it should be devastating. If you're able to walk away and not be devastated, you were never really, really in that contract 100%.
Yeah.
So it makes
it's true. It's true.
So my guest today, Michelle Wiener-Davis, licensed clinical social worker and author of 8 books. You might want to check them out, including Divorce Busting. And don't forget The Sex-Starved Marriage and her most recent book, Healing from Infidelity. And as I said before, you can find out more from Michelle or contact her through divorcebusting.com. It's her website. You can get an intensive, either virtual or visit her in Boulder. Michelle, thank you so much. I so appreciated your time in this hour.
That is such a pleasure. And I know that if we live closer, we'd be best friends.
I hope so. I think you need to come closer to me or I'll come see you.
Okay, sounds great.
If you'd like more information, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Follow me on Facebook or Instagram. And you can podcast the show to share with your friends by going wherever it is you find your podcast. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, leave a review, and you can listen at your convenience. As always, thank you for tuning in, supporting this community, and Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.